at times is becoming farcical. And you have to really feel for these players and management. This isn't normal in any shape or form.
For your first chance to hear Brian O'Driscoll on OTB, download the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
All right, it's bang on 7:30. It's Wednesday morning. You're very welcome along to OTB AM. It's Ger and Owen with you all the way through until 10 this morning. If you want to get in touch, we'd love to hear from you. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. Or, of course, you can always get us by leaving a comment on the YouTube stream, or you can get us on Twitter as well. We also have Nathan Murphy with us this morning. Nathan, good morning to you. We'll get him in 1 second. We're starting with Conor Robinson, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll bring you the audio. Or what do you want to do?
Well, so Callum Robinson was in the press conference yesterday, and it was, I think, fairly obvious that he hadn't been vaccinated from the way the conversation went last time around when he was unavailable for part of the first part of the last international window. When you think that he probably would have got into the team, would have started considering he was a striker in form. Here's what he had to say about vaccinations in the press conference yesterday. Have a look.
Say everyone should be vaccinated, or you shouldn't get vaccinated. I think it's your personal choice. If you want to be vaccinated, then go do it. But if you don't want to, it is what it is. It's everyone's choice. I can't tell people to get it, and I can't tell people not to.
Dave, what's your personal choice, Kat? Have you decided to get vaccinated?
I haven't been vaccinated yet, no. So that's my choice at this moment in time.
So people might think that's unusual given your own personal health experiences.
Yeah, of course. As I said, it's obviously annoying that I've caught it twice, but I haven't been vaccinated. Further down the line, I could change my mind and want to do it, but at this moment in time, I haven't been vaccinated, no.
Dan, do you mind if I ask you why you didn't do that?
I just haven't done it. I think, as I said to you, man, here, it's your personal choice. And my choice at this moment in time, I haven't been vaccinated. I know, as you said, there's managers and people that will want you to do it, which is right in their way of what they think. But everyone has their choice and what they want to do. I wouldn't force it on people to do it or not. It's your choice. It's your body and where you want to.
Fair enough. Do you think you lost caps because of it? You might have avoided the second round.
Well, the first ones, I'm not sure if I could have even had the vaccination last year. So obviously I missed the two. I think I played one. I played the Serbia away. Slovakia away, sorry, and then it was close contact, and then I actually caught it against just before the England friendly, and I missed three games. But I've obviously definitely lost caps through the corona, because of the coronavirus, which is, it's obviously so annoying. That a virus can take away cuts from you, but
if the second time you get that vaccinated, there'd be a huge percentage of chance of not getting it the second time. Do you realise, like, the most recent time?
What, on the other month?
Yeah, if you were vaccinated, you wouldn't have, like,
heard it. Yeah, I know. But, as I said, that was my choice. I haven't been vaccinated, and that's where I'm at the moment. As I said, if things might change, where I think, yeah, I want to get vaccinated, I'm going to do it, but at this moment in time, I haven't made that decision. At the moment, I'm not, no.
So that's the press conference yesterday. Nathan, good morning to you. How are you? I guess it's frustrating for Stephen Kenny that this is still an issue when, as Callum Robinson points out, it did cost him the opportunity to play for his country.
Well, Callum Robinson said it's annoying that he missed that second run of fixtures because of picking up COVID for a second time. It's not annoying. There's a certain inevitability about it if you're refusing to get the vaccine. And it may not be the last time that he ends up missing Republic of Ireland internationals. And we should think back to this time a year ago. A lot has gone wrong for Stephen Kenny since he got the Republic of Ireland job. But COVID, for the first 3-4 months, denied him the opportunity to get any momentum. Think back even to the minutes before the game over in Slovakia, and Adam Eda and Aaron Connolly been ruled out of the match, and then they end up in a situation where there's 14 players from an original squad at one stage missing because of COVID-related issues. So for those of us who have been vaccinated, and everyone around them has been vaccinated, I think it's very hard to understand the reasoning behind this, but we just have to look at the statistics where they still reckon under 50% of Premier League footballers aren't vaccinated.
Yeah.
And is that because they've weighed up the possible effects of testing positive for COVID against the possible effects of getting a vaccine?
Well,
are they anti-vaxxers and in their own little bubble where they don't see anything else, they're only talking to the same people of similar mindset, they don't see anything on social media that doesn't feed into their personal way of life, and they don't see it the way we see it, as straightforward a decision as it was for most people.
It has to be the second of those two options, doesn't it? Because you've got some clubs in the Premier League who are operating at sub 30% vaccination rate, and then you've got Jurgen Klopp coming out the other day to say that Liverpool are at 99% vaccination rate. So this is not an all footballers situation, or because they are professional athletes they are making this decision. This is a culture thing, right?
Well, it's hard to know, right? Is it that certain dressing rooms have loudmouths?
That's what I mean.
Yeah, like and that actually they're a fairly easily led group one way or another. So Man United, the back page of the London Times this morning, are among the Premier League clubs still trying to persuade a number of their teams. They're not believed to be the outliers. There's two outliers who have 20% of their squads, but Manchester United are kind of around the 50% apparently. That's one of the figures that's suggested there. So look, I don't know, the bit where it's like my body, my choice, you know, I see the stealing of the language that they're doing there. I see I see where that comes from, but in this instance that's not actually a reason. So he was asked why, and it was like, well, I just haven't. Like, I haven't because I got information from this source and this source and this source, and I'm concerned about this, 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 and this. And if that conversation happened, and in fairness, maybe a press conference is not the most natural place to do that and to have that kind of back and forth, but at least then you'd know what you're dealing with. At the moment, it's just like, well, it's my choice. I get to decide on this thing. It's like, okay, well, all the people who decided not to get their kids vaccinated against measles, and now measles is making a comeback. Like, vaccination really only works if there's a collective decision made that we're going to go this direction because it's for our collective benefit. The other thing is that, like, there have been cases of fairly severe injury or illness that athletes have been more prone to than the general population. Myocarditis is one of those conditions that is being linked with athletes who go back after having had COVID. Something to do with the quality of oxygen getting to the air of high performance athletes, and there are a few cases of it, but there are a few cases of it in the US in particular. Like, it would be good to know what information the people who are making these decisions are getting, so that you can at least have a conversation about it.
I think you're right. I think there is there are loudmouths in a dressing room who probably are straight out and are reading online and reading what the anti-vaxxers are saying and spreading it and putting doubt into the mind of other players, and then they end up in that same little bubble, and they're reading that, and we know the way that social media works, that once you start reading it you're probably not going to see anything else. But you would have hoped that they would respect and listen to the team doctors at club level enough, who have to be encouraging them to get this. But it's clearly not getting through. And from what I understand, Callum Robinson isn't the only member of the Republic of Ireland squad who's tested positive for COVID. Like, there are quite a few players in this squad. I think Stephen Kenny said he thinks it's single figures who haven't been vaccinated. Like, it's that lack of respect it feels for the other people that you're around, that you've made a decision. Like, it does reduce transmissibility if you are vaccinated. Like, there are lots of people around every club squad, every international squad, who I'm sure in ways are immunocompromised, who I'm sure in ways are in the age group where it's far more dangerous to them than it is to young, fit and healthy footballers. And just think about that for a minute. Just pause, think about it and go, actually, I'll just get this for the betterment of everybody around me. I will take whatever risk is in my head, whatever tiny risk it is. But when you have players who've tested positive twice, and what Callum Robinson was saying second time was, you know, was sick from this.
He had chest issues.
That even still after that, he didn't think, you know, I wouldn't like to get this again. You're fighting a bit of a losing battle with some of these players. And I don't know what Stephen Kenny can do. Like,
well, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about that, because he said that he thinks it's too radical to not pick players who haven't been vaccinated. And, like, in a way, if we were England or Brazil or Italy and we had millions and millions of players and there was a cohort who were unvaccinated and they were deciding that actually they were putting themselves ahead of their team, then you wouldn't pick them. But in this instance, we don't have the strength and depth to go, I'm making this decision, I'm taking this stand. Or do we? Is that actually what we should do? I mean, when the asterisk beside Stephen Kenny is and his record is like, oh, well, actually, he went through the COVID era and he couldn't pick some of his players because they weren't vaccinated. And it's like, next manager comes in. Do you know, like, what do you do living in the real world?
I don't think it's a fair comparison either, because England are selecting players who haven't been vaccinated for COVID. Brazil are selecting players. In fact, we're probably going to find out a little bit more over the next few weeks because of the red list countries in the UK and players who may have to isolate if they're not double vaccinated as who has and hasn't been. So if we look at the Premier League and it's 50%, you'd have to assume the England squad is more or less 50% as well. And Gareth Southgate is picking all those players. So I don't think it comes down to, well, can we risk leaving out Callum Robinson because he's not vaccinated? I think he's just looking at it purely from what Stephen Kenny sees as an ethical point of view. Can I force players to do anything? And clearly feels he can't. I wonder legally, can he force players to have a vaccine to be in a Republic of Ireland squad? But the way around this is probably what is going to happen is that life will become so difficult for those players who aren't vaccinated. We saw with the under 21 squad that Jim Crawford's basically had to name a couple of squads because of red list and telling the young players, if you're not vaccinated, there's a very good chance you're not going to be able to play for Ireland in a lot of these fixtures because you won't be allowed travel. So maybe that is the way around this, is that there will be restrictions on travel for players who haven't been double vaccinated, and that will rule out a lot of players. But will that change their point of view? It doesn't sound like it.
Probably not. Like, I wonder if it, like, the real difference is actually just going to come at club level, because these are the people who employ these players, and it might get to a stage where those players suddenly aren't earning their full wages as a result of not being fully vaccinated, as we're starting to see in the United States at the moment. And that potentially is the next step in this. I think for Stephen Kenny, I think that he would take a stand that a lot of other managers aren't taking, that pretty much every other manager isn't taking at the moment, to leave out a player who hasn't been fully vaccinated. Given his competitive record so far, that is a bridge too far for Stephen Kenny. And can we accept that sort of that slight hypocrisy where, of course, Stephen Kenny is pro-vaccine and wants all his players to be vaccinated while still playing someone like Callum Robinson? I think we can. I think we can get over that. And I think we're in this very complicated situation now where maybe over these next couple of weeks and months, it becomes a more defined thing where that 30% gets much higher in the Premier League. And all of a sudden, it is the vast minority of players who aren't vaccinated. And then you can start having conversations about not being paid for not appearing because you're going to start missing games or whatever. So I think that conversation might come down the line, but maybe that's an optimistic view.
What's happening in the NBA?
Well, in the NBA right now, like, I mean, there's two different conversations. The first one is the lack of speaking out about the vaccines. There's a huge slice of disappointment with LeBron James for not speaking out on this and saying that he's essentially peddling the line. It's your body, you can do whatever you want with it, despite the fact that obviously he spoke out quite a bit last year when there were social justice issues. Of course, a very different scenario, but there is a big difference this year compared to last year when it was a political conversation. What you have is Kyrie Irving, who cannot train in New York at the moment, cannot play in New York at the moment, will miss stretches of home games because he's not fully vaccinated. He's the law in the city right now means that you cannot play there in an indoor setting if you're not jabbed at least once, and he has been hesitant to get his vaccine, so one of their highest paid players will not be able to play as a result of his vaccine status. Steve Nash, their head coach with the Brooklyn Nets, has said that we're not thinking of moving our games or our practices outside of Brooklyn just yet, which is just a bizarre conversation to be having at this point. You've got someone like Andrew Wiggins, who we mentioned on the show earlier on as well, who was one of the bigger voices of not getting the vaccine. He says he's been forced to get the vaccine. Steve Kerr came out over the weekend and said he's got his jab. Andrew Wiggins has come out and said, I was forced to get it and I hope I don't have any health issues in 10, 12 years' time. So there is still that view out there. And however, despite that, there are players who are kind of succumbing to maybe a bit of pressure that they're feeling and getting the vaccine. So that's what I'm wondering. I'm wondering, does the UK and Ireland follow suit over the next couple of months? Now, the NBA is at a 95% vaccination rate. So it is the 5% that are grabbing the headlines. Whereas in the Premier League, what is it, well over 50%. It's a completely different scenario at this point.
Yeah. I mean, obviously something has seeped into the culture where these conversations are happening, and they are, you know, maybe Facebook going down for 24 hours was the window for everybody to get in and go, hey, by the way, did you know the vaccine's actually good for you? You can, you'll be grand. Who knows? Maybe footballers aren't using it. Is there anti-vaxxers on TikTok?
I think there's everything on TikTok. Like the thing with this story as well is that, like, I mean, maybe Callum Robinson deserves a little bit of credit for like actually being honest about it. But I do think
I'd give him much more credit if he said these were the sources. This is what I'm worried about. These are my concerns, as opposed to my body, my choice. Because that's just like it ain't none of your business. And fair enough. But like, if you don't get picked or if you miss games, then you're not as good a teammate as you could be. And you put yourself in this scenario, because there are special rules for those who are vaccinated in terms of being a close contact. And, you know, if you're a close contact and you test negative, but you've been double jabbed, away you go. Life is normal. But not if you haven't been.
Yeah. Like, and I think
I don't want to read too much into his tone. It didn't sound as though he felt as if this was a massive deal that he hadn't been vaccinated. Didn't seem to be making that connection between the fact he had tested positive a second time and not had the vaccine. But I think a huge part is footballers and that bubble and not a full understanding of what's happening, even going all the way back to a year ago. And I know Stephen Kenny didn't want to criticise, but the two players who moved seats on the plane on the way to Slovakia, even that sort of relaxed attitude of, oh, we're in this bubble, we're meant to be separate from everyone else, but does it really matter that much? Yes, it does. Every little thing matters that much. So I don't think we should have any great sympathy for any of these players and any of the hassles that they're going to have over the coming weeks and months, whether it's missing games, whether it's issues with their clubs. Like, this is a decision that they have made on their side, and they're going to have to deal with the consequences.
And that point that you made earlier on, Nathan, as well, I think it's that quote, the sort of, it's so annoying that a virus can take away caps from you, is the thing that people will take away from that and lose sympathy for him immediately. It's almost reminiscent of that Eric Andre sketch where he turns around and shoots Hannibal Buress and is like, who shot Hannibal? It's like, who's to blame for this? And it's like, your decision to not get vaccinated is probably why there have been caps taken away from you. It is something... That quote, for me, is the thing that will lose sympathy with a lot of people when they look at the Callum Robinson quote. And as you say, Nathan, the tone of the piece plays into that completely.
Eric Andre Hannibal Buress.
Yeah. Is this the anti-travelling Wilburys? It's the reverse travelling Wilburys. Anybody over the age of 34 is like, what?
it's a well-used meme on the internet in our brave new world of meme use. You know, he turns around and shoots the guy and is like, who shot Hannibal? There is this sort of confusion within Callum Robinson's tone about it's so unfair and it's a bit unfortunate that somebody can take away caps from you because of a virus. And it's like, there is one solution to that. There is one very obvious solution to that unfortunate annoyance.
I'm Googling the meme now. Oh, okay. Okay, I get it. Right.
Great content.
Quality.
Yeah.
7:48 this morning. Here's what's coming up between now and the end of the show. We have a very busy programme for you. Nathan's going to stay with us and explain to us why Liverpool fans actually really love Mo Salah. We've got Fergal Logan, one of the co-managers of the Tyrone Footballers, with us at 8:05. Sports pages at 8:30 this morning. Nicola Tallon talking to us about her new book and essentially why there is no full-time professional boxing in Ireland at the moment. And then we'll play some Damien Delaney goodness ahead of the Republic of Ireland game this weekend. We haven't talked about the actual match and the importance of these games, and maybe this is exactly what we needed, 24 hours of us talking about this while in the camp they're actually hopefully Callum Robinson looks at the back pages and is inspired to put his best foot forward this weekend, score a couple of goals and get a couple of victories for the Republic of Ireland. What would an acceptable level of outcome be from this double header here, Nathan?
I don't think the Qatar match would be of any great importance, but I think a win in Azerbaijan is a must. They are the minnows of this group, or they should be the minnows of this group. And I think Ireland can't afford, certainly against Azerbaijan, possibly against Luxembourg, to drop points against either of them. Stephen Kenny needs a win. He needs a win. He will see out the end of this campaign. He'll be in charge against Portugal next month and against Luxembourg. I've no doubt about that. But does he get that contract extension? I think they have to beat Azerbaijan and get a respectable performance level. I think Callum Robinson has been a huge loss. I think he could be an absolute key player and should have been a key player for Stephen Kenny over the last year. When he's played, when he's been fully fit, he's been exceptional. He's had that attacking threat that Ireland have lacked at times. So I think if Robinson is fit, he should play. And actually having a front three of Adam Ida, Aaron Connolly and Callum Robinson, you know, I think could carry quite a bit of threat from an Irish point of view. But like, this is the usual build-up to Republic of Ireland squad that we had last month, where it goes under the radar a little bit. We're all talking Liverpool, Manchester City. And by Sunday, Monday, if things don't go well, we're discussing the entire future and everything that's happened over the last 20 years of Irish football. And I wouldn't be surprised if something similar, but I just think they need a win. I think it's as simple as that. Any sort of win means at least, you know, the results conversation stops for a little while. I don't think Qatar is massively important.
Okay, there's no real... up till now, we've had significant injuries. There are some injuries, okay. Obviously, Seamus Coleman is out, Darrell Shea is out. But notwithstanding that, we should still have enough against Azerbaijan.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Azerbaijan are far weaker side than Luxembourg are. So I don't think Ireland, even away from home, if they can get where they were the first 10, 12 minutes at home against Azerbaijan, I think they'll have far, far too much for them. Like, this is not a side, even going to Baku, I don't think it's the most frightening place to go for a match where the atmosphere is so intense that the players won't be able to cope with it. I think they got to go and show away from home, where they've done relatively well away from home. I think throughout Stephen Kenny's time in charge, the better performances have been away from home. I think they just go away and you win this game 2-0, 3-1, and start to build a little bit of momentum. They'd be, you know, three games unbeaten then in the group, get a win against Qatar in the friendly, and then pray to God you can do something similar against Portugal. But like, there's still enough quality. Seamus Coleman's a massive loss. I have thought he might suddenly appear. He was back doing some individual training with Everton at the end of last week, but he just seems to have these constant niggles at the moment that mean he's out for 2-3 weeks at a time. So maybe it was just too much of a risk. But it means Matt Doherty will just slot into that position. They have Enda Stevens back, who can play at left wing back, presuming they go with a three again. And Andrew Onwuamadele steps in for Darrell Shea, as he did that night against Portugal. You have to win these games. I am fully behind the Stephen Kenny project, the future, the building, the opportunities, the transformation in what Irish football should be about. But I think at a base level, you still have to beat Azerbaijan, home or away. And I think you really need to be beating Luxembourg as well.
Okay. The Qatar game, Darren Delaney reckoned last night on the show, was actually important in terms of mood music, atmosphere around the team, confidence. I can see the point. I can see the point of the benefit that the team got from beating the Faroe Islands. Wasn't the Faroes, was it?
Andorra.
Andorra. Sorry, another mighty minnow. That actually,
I think Qatar is important if they don't win on Saturday. If they win on Saturday, and if you lose 3-0 at home against Qatar in front of 10,000 people at the Aviva, there's going to be a problem, and these things can happen. But I think if they beat Azerbaijan, I think the importance of Qatar is nullified somewhat.
Okay. What's your starting front three for the game as things stand, knowing what we know, who's available and who's not available?
I would like to see Adam Ida, Aaron Connolly and Callum Robinson as a starting front three.
Okay, give me your middle three.
I'm trying to go through the team in my head. So I'm going with the back three of Shane Duffy, John Egan, Andrew Omabemadele, Darren Randolph and...
No, Bazunu.
Sorry, Darren Randolph. Bazunu in goal. Enda Stevens left back, Matt Doherty right back. And then I'd only have two in midfield after that, of course. So you're probably going with Josh Cullen and Jeff Hendrick in the middle of midfield.
Okay.
Fresh off his goal-scoring exploits.
Then Robinson and Connolly just in front, either side of Adam Ida.
Okay.
Quality.
Quite attacking. For a team with five at the back, it's quite attacking. Okay. All right.
That's what you want. Go. Win this game.
Yep. It would be good to win this game. it would be good for everybody if we could start talking about the football and... breaking down how we do win these games and how we build on it so far. So.
I'm sorry, I think that will be more or less the team unless he decides to not play one of Robinson or Connolly and put in an extra midfielder, maybe play Jamie McGrath or Jason Knight in midfield.
How is Jason Knight looking? I haven't seen him since he's been back from injury.
He's been injured. So they've obviously decided he's fit enough to come into this squad, and Stephen Kenny clearly has a lot of time for Jason Knight. Whether he's ready to thrust him in here, it might be a little bit too soon, but obviously Malumbi isn't there either, so you'd have to think McGrath is probably the favourite. But I just think if we could get into a rhythm of playing Robinson, Connolly and Ida, that there is enough quality there that against most teams they'll cause them a lot of problems.
Okay, if anybody wants to get in touch this morning, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. You can leave a comment in the YouTube stream, or of course you can tweet us at OffTheBallAM. We should talk about this bubbling story around Mo Salah about how he's not appreciated enough by the Liverpool fans. So the Liverpool fans obviously responded to this by saying, well, yeah, actually I absolutely love Mo Salah more than anything. But is there a case that maybe Mo Salah was like slightly taken for granted, the level of quality, the goal scoring, the rate at which he is established himself as one of the best footballers in the world, while we were constantly listening to people falling over themselves telling us how great Bobby Firmino was and how important he was to that front trio, and how Sadio Mane was probably almost as good, if not better sometimes, than Mo Salah? It turns out there's a clear pecking order, there's a hierarchy here, and Mo Salah is top of the tree by a significant bit.
Mo Salah's probably top of the tree by a significant bit in the Premier League, right, and how he's at that level. And yeah, there was a lot of looking at the qualities of Firmino and Mane and playing down the quality of Mo Salah. And I think you go to Anfield, Liverpool fans adore Mo Salah. They sing the songs, they do all of that. But he is a player who can frustrate at times in that he's always trying something. So quite often he gives the ball away. And Anfield, it doesn't take a lot for a lot of moans and groans to start around the stadium. And that is down that right wing. Alexander-Arnold can give the ball away quite a lot. Salah can give the ball away quite a lot. But it's because they're always trying to make something happen. And I think that maybe fed into a feeling at times, certainly last season that, and the season before, that maybe Mo Salah wasn't fully on top form, that he wasn't doing it all the time. But the thing that stands out for Salah for me, and I was tweeting this the other night, is the games that he does it in, the goals that he scores against all the best teams in the league, he is the one that delivers again and again. And that goal he scored against Manchester City at the weekend, he scored 5-6 times from that exact same position. And that probably sums up maybe the decline from that first season in terms of goals from 32 down to 22. People copped on. Defences copped on to Mo Salah pretty quickly. Look at that goal against Manchester City. Look at the goal he scored against Everton a couple of seasons ago, against Tottenham, against Watford. All of them, there's 4 or 5 defenders right in on top of him. Every time Mo Salah gets the ball, the left back is out, the left winger is back helping out, the left side of midfielders across as well, because everybody knows the damage he can do. Yet still, in the vast majority of games, he finds a way through them. So I think he's probably the most respected player in the Premier League by defenders because of what he can do. And he continues to just find a way through it. And like the quality of the run for the first goal and the quality of the finish for the second goal, I think probably silenced any questions there'll ever be about Mo Salah again. His record, firstly, he's played in 4 seasons over 200 games for Liverpool. So he's always there. He rarely, if ever, misses a match. And his goal scoring record is well over 1 and 2. It's, you know, almost probably 2 and 3 at this stage for Liverpool. So it is that, what does love mean in terms of football? Is he Robbie Fowler? Like, do they call him God? No, but I don't know in modern football if there'll ever be another Robbie Fowler type figure. I don't know. Like, does that figure exist at other clubs?
Well, I guess if a goal scorer emerges at 17 from the local area, that could happen, right? The odds on that happening now are much smaller because the scouting systems, all that kind of stuff, and also economic deprivation around stadiums seems to be much worse now than it was in the 80s in Toxteth, and that was about as bad as it got. So I don't know. It's hard to see anybody ever reaching those high heights again at 17, 18 the way that Robbie Fowler did. But it's not impossible. I mean, if Phil Foden was a goal scorer and he'd come through that system, but even then, it's not the... It needs to be at a club like Liverpool, right? It needs to be at like a super club. It needs to be like.
But Fowler was the mix of God and a cult hero, because not only did he have that talent, that local personality, there was also something else to Robbie Fowler. There was a bit of a messer. There was a bit of
snorting the line.
You could latch on to all of that. Whereas, like, the modern footballer, there's very few of them with that sort of personality. Like Cristiano Ronaldo would be the obvious comparison in the love that is there. But I think that's the fact that he came back, much like Fowler came back to Liverpool in 2006, that the that bond that is there is just exploded because he came back to came back home again. But it doesn't feel like there's a huge amount of players who get the love of the players of the 90s. Now, maybe, again, the kids of today would differ.
Well, let's narrow this down to Premier League era, because obviously Kilkenny is Kilkenny and he's the king. There's many gods, there's only one king. To butcher the Romario line, where in the pantheon of Liverpool greats, and we're talking here, so Premier League era, that, I mean, Michael Owen doesn't get a mention anymore because he signed for Man United, but he did win a European Footballer of the Year as a kid for Liverpool. I would argue Fernando Torres helps to re-establish Liverpool as a global force by signing for them when he does sign for them, and the quality of football that he puts in for a couple of years, which makes it easier for them to sign a Luis Suarez, who obviously then hits even higher heights in some ways than Torres did. And then you've got Mo Salah. So give me a quick power ranking there, Nathan.
It's an incredible thing what they've done over the last 13, 14 years to go straight from Torres to Suarez to Salah to consistently have that brilliant goal scorer. I think Salah is top of that list because of the fact he has brought Liverpool a Champions League and a league title, and the consistency he's done it with over 3-4 years. I would still have Suarez individual season in 2014 up there with anything anyone has done in the Premier League. He was just devastating, but that bit of longevity from Mo Salah puts him at the top of the list out of those three and out of Liverpool attacking players of the Premier League era. The other reason why Salah maybe at times doesn't get all the love is that Virgil van Dijk was on the scene, and Virgil van Dijk was seen as the transformational figure for Liverpool in bringing them from being contenders to being champions. So it's not as if Salah stood out the way that Suarez did. Like, Suarez was comfortably the best player in that Liverpool squad. Fernando Torres obviously had Steven Gerrard alongside him, but I think
so did Suarez.
At their very best, I don't think Gerrard is quite at the same level as he did when Torres was there. But I think Van Dijk in Liverpool's title winning season was obviously Footballer of the Year, and maybe that overshadowed Salah a little bit. But I think for consistency, what he's done over the last 4 years, like, Salah is in, like, you have to think Salah's, you're probably trying to change the system for Liverpool's all-time greatest team, because it's always been Kenny Dalglish and Ian Rush. Like, that's the front two in Liverpool's greatest ever side. Do you now need to sacrifice a midfielder to squeeze in Mo Salah there on the right-hand side?
It sounds like you are. So why did the Telegraph feel the need to write the piece saying that he's underappreciated? Is it because someone were making the arguments about the importance of the other two all the time?
I think it is. I think there was a lot of talk of the crucial role that Bobby Firmino played in linking the midfield and the attack, sort of the on-scene work that Firmino was so good at. And in terms of Liverpool's high press that is so key to them in everything they do, that Sadio Mane was the one who had that work ethic more than anybody else. And that sort of Salah, well, you're just reliant on the genius of Salah. You know, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. But I think it doesn't acknowledge the amount of players he drags away and creates space for Firmino and creates space for Mane, because he is the main threat and teams are aware of that. So Firmino's clearly had a massive dip. Mane isn't at the level he was a couple of seasons either, it feels like, right now. And Salah is just getting better and better right now. So I think that conversation has come to an end. Maybe this has been leaked out by Mo Salah's people to start just putting it out there. It doesn't feel love. This is why he's got to go somewhere where they're really going to preach. Those fans in Paris, they know how to love somebody. See how many Lionel Messi jerseys they bought? They know how to respect somebody. Messi's contract's up the same summer my contract's up. This could work out beautifully.
What's the main replica jersey in Anfield at the moment?
Oh, I assume it's Salah. It's got to be Salah, I'd say, comfortably.
See, that's it. I wasn't really aware of this notion out there that there was a lack of appreciation for Mo Salah. Like, I think he's, like, right on course. He's probably going to win Golden Boot this year, if you look at the early signs. So only three other people have won three Golden Boots, and it's Shearer, Henri and Harry Kane. And it seems even ridiculous that you have to make a case to put him in that category. But I think the weekend feels like a little bit of a watershed insofar as one game can be, where it's like, hold on a minute, anybody who didn't put this guy into the all-time greats in the Premier League, never mind Liverpool, you got to do it now.
No, I think I do. And yeah, as I say, it's always the big games. Every big game Liverpool have played in over the last 3-4 years, Salah has delivered. it is, I think, harking back though to like what do you want? Like, how does he want to be loved? How do Liverpool supporters prove their love for Mo Salah? Like, is it the rivalries that are within the game that like Mo Salah now is never going to be acknowledged because the like, Manchester United supporters can never talk about Mo Salah because now we're so divided that you have to just talk down Liverpool at every opportunity or talk down Manchester United at every opportunity, and Liverpool fans don't defend them enough when they get the opportunity. I don't know. I think there's a lot of love for Mo Salah. Like, maybe they need to put him way above Firmino and Mane and say, get rid of these guys, just keep Mo Salah. Like, I don't fully get it, to be quite honest.
So, in your view, do the Liverpool hierarchy feel the same way, and will they spend the money that's required to keep Mo Salah at the club?
Yeah, I think they do. I'd be with Kenny Cunningham. Made a good comment of like Salah needs to be fair to the club as well, in that, you know, if they offer him 400 grand a year, take the 400 grand a year. Don't say I'm holding that for five, but or a week. Don't say I'm they offer him 400 grand a year. I'd say, lads, your grand, thanks. 400 grand a week. Take the 400 grand a week. They still have quite a bit of time to get this sorted out. There seems to be a bit of chat of maybe very early in the new year. It'll be a nice surprise for the Liverpool supporters. But you do, like Mark Lawrenson was making the point of, or Pat Nevin, of, you know, how much money do you spend to replace Mo Salah?
Yeah, the only thing about that is that if they were to get Haaland and the replacement, like, you're getting a younger player who will, you will then, your succession line will go Torres, Suarez, Salah, Haaland, or Salah, Mbappe, and they're younger, and that's how this business works.
That's a different conversation. I think if that conversation is happening, then it is, you maybe say to yourself, well, we bring in one of them next summer and we leave Mo Salah and let him run down his contract, even have the two of them together for one season. But if it still feels we're a bit away from, certainly they've put a bit in contention for Mbappe or Haaland,
yeah,
that's the caliber you need to replace Mo Salah, somebody who you can guarantee is going to score you 20 league goals a season at least, and is also going to score in every big game.
And there's on that topic, there's a report in Sport Bild this morning that Borussia Dortmund wants to double Haaland's wages to persuade him to stay at the club until 2023. Now, I mean, I'm not sure if that's going to be something that's successful or not, but if it is, then you are looking down the line, you're kind of going through to the end of next season before that actually becomes a possibility, and Mbappe is off the table at this point, which makes holding on to your asset even more essential, I would say, if those two kids are, like, you can't really call them kids anymore, are going to be unavailable, certainly next summer.
Yeah, like Liverpool could end up in a situation where they're signing Lautaro Martinez, you know, signing a new contract. Like, there's an element of risk involved to that. It feels as though Mbappe and Haaland are two of the only young strikers in world football where there's no real risk. Like, everybody expects Haaland, if he signs to someone in the Premier League, is going to score 25 Premier League goals. But that is a big investment, and that is every club in Europe wanting to sign Haaland. And is there a beauty and a magic to Liverpool that he looks at that takes him away from Manchester City and the 100% guaranteed success you're going to have with City? Like, Liverpool, you're also relying on, like, if you're Erling Haaland, the first thing you're asking if you're in a meeting with Liverpool is, how long is that guy staying for? And you're pointing at Jurgen Klopp. Like, that is the number one thing you want to know, because that will be the biggest decision, far greater than Mo Salah. Is there a moment when Jurgen Klopp thinks, you know, I need a break, I want a couple of years out, I'm done with Liverpool, I've achieved everything I can possibly achieve? And that is the biggest threat to Liverpool over the next 4 or 5 years, far greater than Mo Salah even.
No, Stevie G will just step in and take the reins. Stevie G at the wheel, right?
Yeah.
It always works when you get a club legend back.
Exactly. Yeah.
Particularly when it's been successful up north.
Well, if you think it's, it's divisive at Manchester United with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, imagine what it'll be like with Liverpool with Gerrard, where, you know, there'd be those who could look at it dispassionately and think, but this isn't working if it's not working. Whereas he is such a legend in so many people's eyes.
All right.
You could never fire Steven Gerrard.
Well, we'll see. Nathan, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. If you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number. Or, of course, you can leave a comment on the YouTube stream. Now, we're turning back to Gaelic football, and I'm delighted to say we've got Fergal Logan on the line. We're going to get to him in just one moment. Actually, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll get to Fergal Logan. Cheers.
OTB. AM.
So Tyrone managers Fergal Logan and Brian Dewar were awarded the AirGrid Manager Moment of the Month award for September. AirGrid, the state-owned company that's delivering a cleaner energy future for Ireland, has been the official timing partner to the GAA since 2016, and this year announced a 5-year extension of its partnership with the GAA as official timing sponsor. And I'm delighted to welcome Fergal Logan to the show. Fergal, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning. Great, thanks.
What's the aftermath been like of an All-Ireland victory as a co-manager? How have you got to experience it? It's obviously a little bit different this year than other years, but what's it actually been like for you?
Yeah, it's been great. You know, it was fairly chaotic for the first 48 hours, couple of days. The players seemed to enjoy it well. Obviously, everybody involved in the setup, Brian, myself. You know, you do draw some sense of satisfaction and contentment out of a victory like that. And most of all, it seemed to give everybody around Tyrone and maybe even further afield a good lift because, you know, throughout the championship, there was some exciting football, a couple of good semi-finals, good final. And listen, we're just glad and lucky that we come out the right side of it.
Who did you, in the aftermath of the victory, want to spend time with and where did you want to spend time?
Well, undoubtedly, you want to spend time in and around your own family. You know, they're the ones, the wee ones here and Eileen and generally people that are close to you. And, you know, we all like some interaction and some plaudits being thrown at us. So for the couple of days that we had it, it was good to be out and about too and meet people. But essentially, those that live with you and those that are close to you see the endeavour and the sweat and the commitment and the pain that can sometimes follow in being involved in sport and football teams and especially managing teams. So, you know, there are ups and downs. But listen, it was just it's been a great couple of weeks. And hopefully it'll shorten the winter.
Did you watch the game back yet with the management team, just as the management team?
No, not really. Brian's residence is quite a distance from me here. I'm in East Tyrone and Brian's way up in the mountains of North Tyrone, up in the Spurns. So, you know, with the digital onset, with the public health emergency, a lot of stuff's been done over this medium. But I can't say that myself and Brian have sat down together and watched it. But you know, I've watched it and everybody now, analysis is a major, major part of high-end sport and everybody will watch it in their own time and that's the beauty nowadays. You can watch it on your phone, watch it on your iPad, watch it on your computer and you know, we will gather up in a football sense somewhere soon in our minds and get together, Brian and myself and the others that are all involved and push the thing down the tracks. So, you know, I suppose we're still the club championships up and running here and that's going to keep everybody busy for another week or two.
Because whenever we speak to a team who've been beaten in an All-Ireland final, going back and actually watching the match is an important step in improving next year. So I wonder, is that going to be an important step for you getting even better next year? Is actually analysing parts of that All-Ireland final and things you could do even better?
Yeah, well, listen, the pursuit of excellence, I suppose, is what it's all about in high-end sport. And if you're absolutely clinical and ruthless about it, you would set into that game. And when I did watch it, there were certain aspects of it that I thought, well, there you go. But again, you have to balance the psychology of it even with yourself because you could put yourself over the edge worrying too much about everything. You just got to enjoy it. So I think in the main, this side of winter at least, it's a game to be enjoyed and to sit back and watch and maybe at Christmas. You know, we go through a few games and enjoy them and stuff. So because in the end of the day, you've got to enjoy all that's happened and we're just lucky to be part of it.
Are you turning up the commentary full blast when you're watching it back knowing that you've got the job done, listening to the analysts, listening to people beforehand, writing to Ron off and saying, yes, hook this to my veins?
Yeah, well, we all have our inner thoughts about comments that are made in or about ourselves or teams that we're involved in. So, yeah, it's nice to know the result. Let's put it that way. It's nicer and more comfortable to know the result. And yes, you know, whether we like it or not, we try to shut out certain things that come in to the atmosphere at times, but you know, you're interested obviously in hearing what the experts have to say, and sometimes they get it wrong.
It did seem throughout the year maybe that tap wasn't turned off fully. Like, we had Niall Morgan on the show and he was well aware of some of the analysis of him in the aftermath of the semi-final. I know Con Kilpatrick on Instagram was tagging Andy Moore and Paddy Andrews, questioning their analysis of their midfield, and I think Conor Myler said something similar as well. How important was that throughout the year, actually tapping into some of the things that have been said about the team and using that for motivation?
Yeah, there's a small bit of psychology in that and the famous line that, you know, it's best to have a chip on the shoulder and preferably two chips on the shoulder. You know, when you go about high-end sport or business or whatever, you need a hunger. And sometimes you self-motivate that hunger out of the thoughts and comments of others. But, you know, we wouldn't want to go too deep on that side of it. And players should be generally sensible and should understand that, listen, everybody's got opinions. Sometimes we're wrong, sometimes we're right. Everybody puts them out there. People put them out there to greater or lesser degrees. Some people feel the urge to put it out there all the time and to very high degrees. So, you know, sometimes people can take an edge off that. But in the end of the day, you're self-motivated. you're within your own group. And, you know, I think essentially my advice to players would be stay within your own thoughts. Don't put yourself up for any public comment unnecessarily and just get on with the job in hand, which is just playing football.
And is there any part of you as a manager that tries to control that or tries to encourage it in a healthy way? Because, I mean, anybody who's seen A Year Till Sunday will have seen John O'Mahony with the newspaper clipping saying this is what people are writing about you. Is there anything that you as a management get involved with on that level, or do you just leave it up to the players to find that stuff for themselves?
Generally, it's a fairly joined up and communicative world. Everybody is not long. You can eat your breakfast and you can see all you need to see in 20 minutes on your phone from all angles. So now and again, you would tap into it. And, you know, sometimes there's an edge to be got. I suppose it depends on the lead into games, you know, what you need and what pitch the thing needs to be set at. So, you know, I wouldn't say we try to block players from doing anything because it's their lives, it's their comment, you know. But we expect them to present themselves properly for Tyrone. We expect them to play good football for Tyrone. And now and again, we would tap into the odd bit of stuff, but we wouldn't want to get too carried away with it. But there are some motivational levers that you can take from other people and other people's comments.
Fergal, can you take us back to the first time that yourself and Brian Dewar sat down and thought about taking an underage team together? Like, was it just from conversations that you'd had over the years that you shared a fairly common view of what football should look like, how it should be played? What was the instinct on both parts for you guys to think we could team up here?
Yeah, well, it was part coincidental in truth because, you know, the Tyrone Under 21 job came up and I found myself in the middle of that. Brian had been involved the year before. Myself and Brian had played together. Peter, we'd played with Peter too. And it sort of just, in one sense, we fell in together. I can't say that we sat and we talked football. We talked ambitiously that we'd want to manage Tyrone seniors. When I finished with Tyrone, or finished with Georgetown Harps, the furthest thing from my mind was that I would ever manage a football team, never mind Tyrone seniors. So, you know, and it just developed. And genuinely, this year, people will say, well, did you sit down and did you and Brian plot to win an All-Ireland and did you this, that and the other? We plotted to get to the first training session. We had the lockdown situation. We plotted to get training session to training session. We mucked in. We took the games thick and fast and we just rode the waves. So, you know, I'd love to say that there was some master scheme or greater plan, but, you know, Brian does things in the moment and he does them with passion and with a desire to win. Peter it worked well at under 21 level, the three of us mucking in, so to speak. Peter's massive football brain and otherwise brain. So between the three of us, we sort of hived things up at under 21s, just moved forward into seniors. Peter, for his own reasons and the family connections and all that goes with it, Peter did the noble thing and said, listen, guys, I can't necessarily be involved in that management. It might be unfair to others in his watch who didn't have people over the top of them when they were coming up through their football careers. So listen, you know, sometimes fate, sometimes luck, sometimes design. So it's probably a mix of everything. But listen, we're just glad that the marriage worked out happily thus far.
And so obviously, you as you said, you played football with Brian. Were you mates? Like, and when you were with the under 21 and then under 20 grade, at that grade, were you having conversations and realizing actually this relationship does work?
Yeah, probably to a degree, but I'm going to be very honest with you. Brian's a particularly busy guy. I find myself particularly busy. There's not a lot of time and sort of for sitting down and saying, well, this is great. And you know, obviously you need some element of relationship and trust. And I suppose when we set out, the first night we set out, it was put to us that joint management may not work. And you know, much like in right now, I simply said it, called it as I saw it, and I said, listen, it doesn't cause me one iota of thought to be involved in joint management. you rise or fall as a team and players together. You rise or fall as a management team together. When I say a management team now, I mean the full treatment of everybody that goes with an intercounty backroom team. And listen, you know, it's somewhat overstated. You're as good as your players, and it's always a collective for me. I can't consider any other position that is not a collective. And I'm happy, I'm glad that Brian's position with myself, because there were some people who put it to us even on the first night, listen guys, joint management doesn't work.
And obviously you've managed to prove that wrong over the period of time. It's a remarkable achievement. One other thing just on this before we move on to something else. With Joe McMahon on, and you know, you talk about people with giant football brains, we had the pleasure of having, just as he finished his career, having him on a few times and spending some time in his company. You could tell he thought about the game kind of differently, and he was saying to us afterwards that, like, he feels free in the environment to come forward with ideas and suggestions and nominations, really, about selection, but ultimately the decision rests with you guys. Again, that's an interesting dynamic. Where have there been times over the course of the year where you thought, actually, I want this guy to play, and Brian thinks, you know, maybe not this week? How do you work through those little knots?
Yeah, well, listen, the coaching that Joe and Collie Holmes and Peter Donnelly did on the field, and Des McGuinness goalkeeping, for me, that was the crux and the core of how we won it. After Killarney, we set out and we trained hard. We coached, we coached, we coached. I'll say we coached. I'll say Joe and Collie and Pete coached very heavy. In terms of myself and Brian, you know, Brian summed it up well when I overheard him being interviewed one night when he said, you know, we don't always agree on everything, but, you know, we always reach an agreement. So listen, you know, of course, everybody has different subjective views of players, what they bring to a team. And there are a few moments when you're locked in a bit and your thoughts mightn't just align in terms of a player, his contribution. Does he start? Does he come on? Is he in the 26? Is he not in the 26? But, you know, we managed to work most things out. And you know, when you're bringing on good footballers into a team and when you're dealing with good footballers, you know, generally things look a lot better than they might otherwise look, having seen it at all grades, you know.
Well, when you think about it, the hive mind is always better and more interesting than a single individual's. Like, it, just because you push yourself, you guys have to have your view fully thought out, and you need to have second level, second order thinking. Well, what's going to happen after that, you know? And then all of a sudden, you're both reaching a deeper understanding of each other's positions. And when that works, that's unbelievably powerful.
Yeah, because, you know, nobody's an island and nobody has all the answers. And at the end of the day, as you say, if you're challenged when you put forward a name or a player that you want to play, you have to have your good reasons and your reasoned decision set out, and it will be challenged. And that goes for everybody, the three coaches, Holmesy, Joe, Peter. You know, we would take soundings from everybody. I suppose ultimately the buck stops with Brian and myself. So, you know, it's a happy collective and it worked out well this year.
That Killarney game has become something of a road to Damascus moment, it seems. It certainly, when the book is written about Tyrone's victory this year, there's going to be a full chapter on that game in Killarney. What's your reflections now on what the team did in the build-up to that game, why that game went the way it did, and the lessons that you learned? How do you think about that match now, in isolation in some ways?
Yeah, well, listen, we were just delighted to stagger through the three-team group or four-team group of all the northern counties here. And a draw at the last dying breaths with Monaghan got us through. We were delighted to get a semi-final against a team like Kerry. In one sense, the trip was a sort of a double edge, because we thought, well, listen, it's a chance to get away with everybody and try and build the thing. And we had a very good weekend in Killarney, save for the 70 whatever minutes it was. And you know, the reality is that I would love to say we were either training that morning or we were out the night before. You know, we got off the bus and to stretch our legs, we walked around the National Park and the threw American footballs at each other and rugby balls and fisted a few balls. The next morning, maybe they saw members of the backroom team all out jogging. The gym was open for people outside of the 26, maybe. But, you know, there was no... We went at that as a very, very important game. And we came up with our tails between our legs, well chastened, and we shipped six goals. I genuinely don't remember shipping six goals standing on the sideline with Stewartstown Harps, and we've had some difficult days, and it's nothing other than it seems to everybody else is that Tyrone took an absolute kicking in Killarney that day.
What did the coaching involve after that? Because you mentioned that the three lads really, really went to town coaching wise over the following couple of months.
Well, I suppose where we were lucky was that we were late out in the Ulster Championship, so we'd had only a couple of weeks lead into the National League because of the lockdown. So we didn't get together until just before the National League started. Then obviously the focus was on that, and probably that was the luckiest period for us because I think we had a 3 or 4 week gap, and one that meant we could do some hard physical training and run hard because we'd no immediate games in sight. And two, it gave us an uninterrupted phase of coaching. And that was, I think we played Cavan on the 10th of July in Omagh. Killarney was the 12th of June. So that, for me, was the month that helped set the foundations in place. And then after that, you're back in games and you're building, the team built itself physically and confidently, and as each game went by in the championship. And it just worked out from there.
What was the biggest improvement then as a result of that coaching?
Well, the biggest improvement overall, probably one, we got drilling into some heavy running, and unless you've the leg work done, as we all know, you know, the mind can weaken quicker than it should. So we got that done. Then we got some work done, and I'm not going to throw it all out for everybody else, but we did look, and so much systems is somewhat overstated, but we looked at some tackling, turnovers, where to do this, where to do that. And we just had time to shape things up a bit. Maybe we were overambitious, thinking we could just take Killarney on or carry on in Killarney and just toe-to-toe it. We toe-to-toe it all year, really. We didn't come away from that. But maybe we've got time just to walk it out and talk it out on the training field, and that's where the learning's done.
It seemed that Tyrone at the end of the year had provided an unbelievable template for teams in future. And template's probably the wrong word. What I mean is that what we saw early on in the game was cornerbacks coming up, scoring unbelievable points. I think the Hampsey score off the outside of the right boot was just a gorgeous score early in the first half. And what we had was a team where if you played your number 15 as your number 1 and your number 1 as your number 15, you'd probably still beat a lot of teams as well. How much of a thing was this throughout the year from your perspective, Fergal, knowing that there was this versatility around the pitch, footballers everywhere on the pitch?
Yeah, well, that's a tribute to the quality of player in Tyrone, you know, and the semi-final, the All-Ireland semi-final, the full back line were the people on the board early on. Paddy scored a couple of clinking points off the outside of the right boot. So, we're back to this possession game. We're back to everybody being comfortable on the ball. And I suppose that's the key moment because, you know, I have said it for years that your full back line is your most potent attacking weapon because they come onto the system, certainly during the defensive years. They come into the play late, and during the blanket defence, which I thought would wash itself through, and hopefully it has washed itself totally through the system now. But, you know, they were your most potent attackers. So everybody needs to be comfortable on a football field nowadays. Listen, the goalkeepers, as you've seen, need to be super confident and composed on the ball. So it's a long way from my day, to be honest. But we're blessed in Tyrone. We have a good standard of footballers with a good skill set. And we don't mind who kicks the points, to be honest. As long as they go over the bar, we're only measured in one item, and that's over the bar or under the bar. So listen, it doesn't matter to us. And of course, everybody would be encouraged to take their shot and get on with it because, you know, nobody's that special around the outfit that every shot must go through him.
Why were you confident that the defensive systems and the blanket defence would wash themselves through? Because there was a lot of conversations about rule changes and changing the game in order to get rid of it. But obviously you were sure that it was just a phase.
Yeah, no, I've said for 6, 7, 8 years that this would wash itself through because it's just one of those things. One, it's a bad start to set out just to defend, or to primarily defend. And I just felt that, you know, it wouldn't prevail because it just was artificial, contrived a bit, you know. But listen, that's progress in one sense. That's team development. That's systems development. You know, and we'll move through more phases before it's all out. But I was always confident that would wash itself through the system, and I think you know, in one sense this year might have seen it washed through.
I think that's really interesting, the point you made about no one is special, because there's definitely counties where players are encouraged not to shoot, that you've got to find the shooter. Your job is to make sure you carry the ball and transition to the scoring zone. In the scoring zone, you give it to somebody who we know is going to have a 70 to 90% success rate. Whereas with you guys, it's like, if the shot's on, take the shot. That speaks to a great confidence in the player's ability, but also a trust and a freedom that they have.
Yeah, but it would be wrong of me to say that, you know, we're not saying, listen, shot selection's important. Shot selection's absolutely critical, because every point's a prisoner. So, you know, if you're in the right position and it's the right shot to take, it doesn't really matter who it is. Obviously, there are percentages and everybody keeps their conversion rates, and sometimes you'd prefer, you know, Darren McCurry swinging onto his left boot than another, but in the scheme of it, it doesn't work that well. You can't control all those things. So listen, everybody's got to get up and at it and get on with it. So listen, it worked.
It's not machine learning. I did want to ask you, we're given to understand that many of your players support option B going ahead to Congress in now 2.5 weeks. As somebody who's been involved in Ulster football all your life and has seen the highs and the lows and also the difficulties of coming through Ulster and winning in All-Ireland, where do you stand on the football structures as they are at the moment? Do you have a strong view on A, B or status quo?
Well, listen, we've been looking backwards as we discussed to this point, really, and I haven't even had a genuine long conversation with any conversation much with Brian or with even the players and stuff. So you might be ahead of me and where players might feel things should go to. The bottom line is, you know, the association always endeavours to do its best by everybody, in my view. And, you know, they're trying to create a situation where everybody's in the race for Sam and everybody gets good, competitive, meaningful games at their own level and at their own grade. Now, how that's done, I'm not so sure. Ulster Championship of itself is competitive, as we know. The more competitive it is, the better it is for every county in Ulster. So, you know, an Ulster Championship would be hard to give up because it has such tradition and history, as you say, and it remains a very competitive province, and we possibly were the better of coming out of it this year and all the tight games that we had. So this is a very, very difficult one. It's a very, very important one. I think a lot of thinking going into it over the next couple of weeks. I wouldn't be afraid of change necessarily, because, you know, in the end of the day, you can change and you can always experiment and roll back. I don't know, they didn't get the third year of the Super 8's run. There seems to be less of a feel for it to let it run its trial period. So it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks. I wouldn't have formed any major view on it. I've been looking backwards, but I hope to get to all that somewhere.
Do you have a hunch?
You know, I think you need to be playing at a level that works for your team. And I know from my own club, I know the feeling of being a smaller fish in the pond with my own club here in Tyrone, Stewartstown Harps. I know that when they created the junior, intermediate and senior Ulster clubs and All-Ireland clubs, it was one of the best things that ever happened within the association, because every junior footballer and every junior hurler could finish up playing in Croke Park on an All-Ireland final club day. We managed to go to an All-Ireland club final junior in 2005, and we met a Kerry team who put manners on us again. Finug, but ultimately we felt we were the best footballers in Ireland at that stage, even though it was a junior, you know. So I just think it's critical that everybody gets competitive, meaningful games in decent weather, preferably spring, and how that's done, you know. Does option B leave the odd mismatch at the end of it all when teams come up into the final edges of it? I'd need to look at it well. I'd need to study it. I'd like to talk it out with others and see where all our thoughts rest.
All right, Fergal, great to have you with us this morning. Congratulations on an amazing year. Enjoy watching the video whenever it happens collectively, because there are some incredible highlights, some all-time great moments. Sorry, there was one last thing I wanted to ask you about. Conn Kilpatrick went public on Monday night on the Claire Byrne show on TV. It takes a lot for a young man to go public and speak about the difficulties he's had, but it's a very important topic that he raised when he talked about his addiction to gambling. You guys have obviously known about this over the period of time, and I just did want to offer you the opportunity to pay testimony to his character coming through the way he did and being somebody who's willing to come forward now and have that conversation publicly.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, this is a very, very serious issue. Whatever about all the football issues that surround us and they keep all our thoughts tied up at times, you know, there are real life issues with the public health emergency, gambling, all sorts of addictions out there. Testament to Colin's character is how he did with the Tyrone team this year, because I remember putting him on the last minute in Killarney, which was a sort of a graveyard shift for him, and I'm not so sure, I haven't discussed it with him, he wasn't that overly impressed, but listen, he dug in the football field and he produced a display for the ages in the All-Ireland final. You know, everybody in his own club in Edendork, and Tyrone's very proud of Colin. And you know, we did know that he had some battles, and we believed and understand that he's rode them all out. And isn't it great that he was able to stand forward, say his bit, and again with the benefit of others in mind and thoughts for others, because it's a very, very difficult world, and there are lots of traps that young people can fall into. But Colin has stood forward, said his bit. He's an outstanding individual. He's an outstanding footballer, as you see or as you saw. So listen, let's just hope that helps somewhere out there, some small way out in the real world. And you know, we all, his own club has been behind him, and all the county will be behind him. So that's just a difficult time that's hopefully passed in Colin's life.
Fergal, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. Cheers.
Thank you.
It's Fergal Logan there, of course. Tyrone managers Fergal Logan and Brian Duher were awarded the Airgrid Manager Moment of the Month Award for September. Airgrid, the state-owned company that's delivering a cleaner energy future for Ireland, has been the official timing partner of the GAA since 2016, and they've this year announced a 5-year extension of their partnership with the GAA as official timing sponsor. This Tyrone team aren't going anywhere anytime soon.
No, definitely not. And clearly they've got excellent management, and they've really structured a charge towards the All-Ireland this year, and it paid off. And even if they didn't win the All-Ireland, you would be thinking to yourself, God, this team is going to be around for a while. The fact is now that they're going to be totally bolstered confidence-wise heading into next year and the next couple of years. And it's actually kind of hard to know what benefits them with regards to special Congress over the next little while, because of course the Ulster Championship is great, and the strongest voices against any change would be in Ulster, and Tyrone obviously won the All-Ireland after being Ulster champions this year. But as you made the point yesterday, by and large Ulster can weaken you because it's so strong. So it'll be interesting to see how things go for them were there to be change.
I think, like, if it, just to park everything for a moment, right? If you had a Division 1 where the Dubs are challenged week in, week out, where away from home their form hasn't been, we're going to beat you by 5 to 9 points the way it has been in Croke Park sometimes in the league over the years, that actually in Clonus, in Oma, in Ballybuffet, or in Castlebar or in Killarney, wherever those away games are, and let's say they've got 4 away games for the first year, I think those games are going to challenge Dublin and give the analysts tape on the weaknesses of this Dublin team that we never get to see. Like, you don't know how to challenge Dublin because in the All-Ireland quarterfinals, because you haven't seen them play anybody. You don't know, like, defender X has a propensity if you go on his inside to foul. You don't know that because you haven't seen it, whereas all of a sudden that tape emerges. And if I was in charge of any of those teams in Ulster, I'd be like, let's get them and let's get Kerry into situations where they're gasping for breath, and let's see what they're made of.
Let's drag them up to our level of competitiveness in the most important part of the year. Would definitely be a competitive sort of argument in favour of that, but it doesn't come down to that. As we now know from yesterday's exploits on the show, it is not about the competition whatsoever. It's going to be I would say it'll be a financial decision, and hopefully we get clarity on that over the next couple of days, actually.
It's 8:40 this morning. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Will O'Callaghan is with us this morning. Will, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, lads. Yeah, good.
What's going on?
Well, look, as you've been discussing from the top of the show, Callum Robinson says he's refused a COVID-19 vaccine despite contracting the virus twice. The West Brom forward has missed 8 of the last 13 Republic of Ireland games for virus-related reasons. Robinson was absent from last month's World Cup qualifier against Portugal in Faro after he contracted coronavirus for the second time. He says it's his personal choice not to be vaccinated now.
It's your personal choice. My choice at this moment in time, I haven't been vaccinated. I know, as you said, there's managers and people that will want you to do it, which is right in their way of what they think, but everyone has their choice and what they want to do. I wouldn't force it on people to do it or not. It's your choice, it's your body.
not uncommon for players in England currently not to be vaccinated in football squads. The Premier League have announced in recent times that only 7 of the 20 squads have got more than 50% of their players double vaccinated currently. Remember Jurgen Klopp speaking quite passionately about the issue last Friday. Stephen Kenny was also asked about players in the squad who've taken the same stance as Callum Robinson. Around 10 are currently not fully vaccinated. Kenny says he would prefer all of his players to have both jabs, but he won't be excluding players based on their vaccination status.
I think for the individual association to just come together and say we're not selecting anyone who hasn't got it would create as many problems, you know, would create problems we don't need to have for ourselves.
Meanwhile, Italy and Spain on the pitch meet in the semi-final for the second time in 4 months tonight. The recently crowned European champions will welcome Spain to the San Siro for a semi-final of the UEFA Nations League. Kick-off in Milan is at 7:45 Irish time. Former Republic of Ireland defender Damien Delaney thinks Manchester United are being held back by their manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. The Red Devils were held to a 1-0 draw by Everton in the Premier League last weekend, some 7 days after losing at home to Aston Villa. Delaney says United's title chances are being hampered by not having a manager of a similar level to their rivals.
He's just not at the level required of the same guys that he's up against. You watch that game, Liverpool and Man City at the weekend, the tempo, the tactics, the in-game tactics, the substitutions, it was incredible. It was you were tired watching it. Mm. You just don't believe that Manchester United are capable of partaking in a game of that calibre at the moment.
Sport Ireland CEO John Tracy, meanwhile, says a proposed new velodrome will not only benefit elite athletes, but also the public in a wider sense. A national velodrome and a badminton centre for the Abbottstown campus have been given government backing under the National Development Plan. The facility will have a capacity for some 900 spectators and will be able to stage both national and European events. Adre Smith has been cited for an alleged bite on Munster hooker Niall Scannell. The incident occurred during last weekend's United Rugby Championship game, which Munster won at Thomond Park. The Stormers' second row will face a disciplinary panel via a video conference tomorrow. Jordan Lammer is in contention to make his first appearance of the season for Leinster. The fullback has returned to full training, having recovered from a groin injury. Leinster yesterday also confirmed that Dennis Leamy had taken up a role as the province's skills coach, especially in the contact zone. Leinster forwards coach Robin McBride has been discussing exactly the brief that Leamy will be taking up.
Both from a defensive point of view, looking at the tackle, looking at the tackle area, and from an attacking point of view, in ball carrying, ball placement, everything around the ruck, really. So he's been charged with that. And to date, you know, he's given a couple of presentations already. He's definitely a passionate rugby man.
Titi Tuimaga will have to wait until he gets a visa before being able to line out for his new club, Connacht. The Samoan prop was signed yesterday by the Western Province following an ACL injury, which was sustained by Irish international Dennis Buckley. Head coach Andy Friend hopes to have his new signing available on the pitch by December. Donald Cusack is among the favourites to be named the next Cork under-20 hurling manager. Pat Ryan stepped down yesterday after delivering back-to-back All-Ireland titles in the calendar year of 2021. Cusack left the position of minor manager last year, with his successor Noel Furlong delivering an All-Ireland title of his own. Both Furlong and Cusack are now considered the front runners to replace Ryan, based on this morning's papers. Brian Dowling will be remaining in charge of the Kilkenny senior Camogie team for next season. The 2020 All-Ireland winning boss was last night ratified for what will be his third year at the helm. Kilkenny surrendered the O'Duffy Cup with a semi-final defeat to Cork this summer. It's understood that England's Ashes cricket test against Australia, the tour this winter, will go ahead, with Test captain Joe Root leading an almost full-strength squad. Positive talks are believed to have been held with England's players last night, who had expressed concerns about quarantine restrictions going into Australia. Discussions with Cricket Australia are due to resume later this morning. And the going is yielding ahead of this afternoon's 8-race meeting at Navan. The first at the Mead track there of 8 will go to post at 1:15.
Well, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. Cheers.
Cheers, lads.
Will O'Callaghan giving us your daily sports news fix. It's 8:44. Now, episode 22 of the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy is now available to listen to. You'll get it first on the OTB Sports app every Tuesday, everywhere else from Wednesday morning. To subscribe to the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy. This week, Tyrone All-Ireland winner and former AFL star Conor McKenna joined the pod. We learned a good bit more about him. Have a listen.
A lot of people mightn't realise this, but you wanted to be a jockey when you were 13 years old.
Yeah, I quit football for a year when I was, 13 or 14 now. So I went to a couple of stable yards and rode out most mornings and then tried to be a jockey. But I was a
tough
bit...
life. That's a tough life.
A bit heavy, about 13 years of age, I was pretty happy for it. So that took a downfall, very quickly. But it honestly is still my first love. Like, it's, I would put it ahead of Gaelic football and
Really?
Most other things. Oh, it's, I bought two horses and I trained them, sort of me and my dad trained them, and dad's a license, so just looking after them. But that was my first love. And then sort of, that's a sort of a weird one, because I never really loved playing Gaelic football when I was younger. And then sort of the minors was one of the probably most enjoyable years I had, getting to the final. It was just a great group of lads, and the crack we had that year was unbelievable. And then I went to Australia, and seeing the under 21 boys win all Ireland when I was in Australia probably was one thing that I sort of felt sort of sick about, and it was probably when I realised I actually do want to win all Ireland. So that sort of hit home with me. And then I went to the Ireland final in 2018, and the first 20 minutes were in throwing, went probably 5-2 up or 5-3 up. I thought I was going to be sick, like it was just hard to watch. So it sort of, it hit home then that
you were getting sick at that stage as well.
Oh Jesus, I was like, I want to obviously want to be part of it. So
yeah,
that was really the probably, but it wasn't when I was younger, it wasn't really anything I really,
you caught a bug. It's funny, because if anyone was listening to last week's episode, they would have heard Paddy talking about being dropped in 2011 from Dublin. He was 22. He'd been on the panel for 4 years, and he told us he was in tears in his or crying in his parents' house watching the All-Ireland final in 2011 on his own, and he had missed it. So I suppose, without jumping to conclusions here, boys, you seem to get caught by the same bug of trying to write it, you know?
Well, it's slightly different with me. I was dropped because I was going on the piss. Connor wasn't there because he was a professional athlete. So it's, I like the way you've tried to link it. So I'll take that.
Well, you were going to join a manor.
And then I tried to join soccer as well then.
Yeah, really interesting stuff there. I had no idea. I mean, obviously, he ends up being a little bit too big to be a jockey, but there's a post-Gaelic football career for Conor McKenna. That is this week's episode of the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy. I did feel like, geez, I wonder what they're going to do in the off-season. And then the first one after the All-Ireland final was the one where they interviewed each other, and it was absolutely sensational. And this week, they've got Conor McKenna on, so... The old cliche about knocking it out of the ballpark, that's exactly what they've done with Football Pod with Paddy and Andy. Episode 22 there, you can get it there. Loads more, including his AFL experience, what changed when Mickey Hart left, and why GA is never going to be the number one thing in his life. Right, it's 8:47 this morning. We should talk about how good it feels to see Dennis Leamy in his Leinster gear. It's one of those things that really gives me a warm feeling. It's like, wow, look what we just did. Us being Leinster, obviously, and you being Munster in this instance. We took your boy, we've taken his skills, we've injected them into the best young players in the country, and we're going to show it in your face now for the next decade on the back of this man's genius. Leamy was always one of my favourite Munster players. I mean, if you're allowed to have favourite Munster players when you're a Leinster fan, but like, he would tear up trees for Ireland. His performance in Twickenham against England, got to mix up my ears here now, but the Shane Horgan 2 tries, he is sensational in that game. He is just like brute force, brilliant intelligence. There's a line out towards the end of the game where it's just Leamy, where you're just like, Leamy! And there he is looking spiffing in his Leinster gear. It just seems to fit him. I think maybe what Leinster should do is just decide that Tipperary is actually really culturally more Leinster than Munster.
Oh my God, here we go.
We'll just take Tipperary from you. You're not really using it. No. You kind of seem to be underutilising it.
That is it. I mean, I'm just going to decide that.
I think you'll find Trevor Hogan also a key member of the Leinster backroom team.
This imperialistic view that you so rail against quite often on this show has reared its head in truly disgusting form this morning.
The best
trying to annex Tipperary for Leinster.
Well, I mean, Aidan O'Brien's actually...
Offaly should be a Munster.
Aidan O'Brien's
Kilkenny should be a Munster.
Look, I mean, I think Offaly spiritually feels a bit more like Munster. Maybe you can have it. Maybe it's a fair trade.
No, I wouldn't trade Tipperary for Offaly, sorry. But I would take Offaly, you know.
Oh, no, it's a trade.
Free.
It's a trade.
We'll take the Larrys. No
so
problem.
How do you feel as a dyed-in-the-wool Munster rugby fan? feeling Dennis Leamy, seeing Dennis Leamy in the photograph, was like, yeah, that looks good.
I think Rory O'Connor in the Independent today has a list of the wild geese. So I'm considering Dennis Leamy a wild goose of Munster. Van Gran and Corr just keeping the seats warm for a Rog, O'Connell, Leamy, Mike Prendergast, dream team to come back. a travelling Wilburys collection of monster geniuses to come back one day down the line. So it's okay. I mean, you're leathered with money in Leinster. You've got an unbelievable private school system and you don't know what to do with your cash. And it's great that you're able to fund the development of a great young coach like Dennis Leamy, and we will be truly grateful for your service down the line.
You're doing a great job of keeping your best people associated with the team. Oh no, so here's Rory O'Connor's list in the Independent today. Dennis Leamy, Leinster's newly appointed contact skills coach. Dunnock O'Ryan, who's obviously finished his career at Racing and is now part of La Rochelle's coaching ticket. Mossy Lawler, backs coach at Connacht. He works with his cousin and fellow Shannonman Colm Tucker, who handles defence. Felix Jones, obviously famously part of Razzie's setup, learning all the dark arts. James Collin, a coach at Poe. He became a coach at Poe in 2017, now defence coach at Toulon. Mike Prendergast, obviously, who is now Racing 92 attack coach. Paul O'Connell with Ireland. Flannery, who obviously won the Premiership last year with Harlequins, really quickly got to Harlequins, team goes and explodes. Ronan O'Gara, obviously, at La Rochelle, and Declan Kidney at London Irish, who seems to be getting better as well. It's like, that's pretty amazing.
That's what happens when you have green shoots all the time in a phenomenal part of the country. Great people are just going to have to fly away for a little while and come home when they're all ready. So I think this is something that people should be proud of, that there are all these fingers in the pies across Europe and across Ireland as well.
If the Ireland coaching job becomes available after the Rugby World Cup and the Leinster coaching ticket is transfixed to the Ireland one, which would seem like a fairly, it's not that controversial to say so. Maybe Paul O'Connell, who's already in the setup, would step up. It's not a done deal, but at that point you could easily see O'Gara and Leamy and Flannery in charge.
Oh my God.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Well, here's the thing. For that to happen,
O'Gara plays a Leinster style of rugby. Maybe he wouldn't be that welcome in Munster anymore, you know?
For that to happen, I would say that, first of all, yes, you would need the Leinster team to take up the national post. But you would also need, I suspect, this current Munster ticket to still be in charge, which means that Munster have won some silverware at the end of the season.
It could be Larkham in charge, couldn't it?
There would be some sort of moving. I'm not sure, though. I think the criticism that has existed for Munster has been ticket-wide. It hasn't just been towards Van Graan. Van Graan's got the sharp end of it.
I don't think that's... to be honest, I disagree with that. So, that's up for grabs.
Really, do you think... I thought Larkham came in for a good bit of criticism at the end of last year when...
I think
Munster
people are seeing
a little bit unimaginative in an attack.
I think people are seeing the signs of what Larkham can do, definitely. I think Larkham's reputation is big, so...
Well, either way, if you allow me to exist in this fantasy world for a moment where Munster have won the Champions Cup or the URC at the end of this season, it means they've come upon some sort of success that they haven't had in 10 years, and as a result of that, things are going okay for Munster. So either way, it's a win-win. Either you've got your boys home.
So you've won a league title. Say you win a league title and then next year you don't win the league, and then the lads move on, the coaching ticket with Leinster moves on to Ireland, and then it's like O'Gara and... I mean, it would be a bit of a homecoming for Felix Jones. O'Gara, Felix Jones and... I don't know. Any other connection there?
Yeah, but like, it's great because it'll be like inside agents in South Dublin
winning the European Cup,
where like they have their ear to the ground. They're watching St. Michael's games to scout for Leinster, and actually it's like, yeah, we got this kid James Ryan, just not good enough for Leinster. I think Munster look, I need for a second row there. Paul O'Connell's just after retiring, let's send him down the road. So this, no matter what way you look at it, is just a perfect scenario.
Well, congratulations to Dennis Leamy on stepping up to be involved with the Leinster senior team. It is great that there is a pathway for young Irish coaches to progress through the provinces and to get jobs, and to be part of that coaching system is actually a clear sign that things are working well. You could definitely do it some more, and you know, I actually think there's a good chance Andy Friend would be an amazing Ireland coach, like, and he might well be a candidate for it. So he's going to be on the show on Sunday. Looking forward to hearing what he has to say. Really interesting in the papers today, talking about how the Jake White comments aren't water off a duck's back, that actually it's frustrating listening to people say that about Connacht, because it's not true, and that he knows the work that goes in, and he knows that the identity that they're creating is something unique and different. And I think you see it, and you certainly, anytime we had him in at a show we did in Galway, and you come away from every interaction with him feeling positive about life, positive about his own belief system and the quality of work that he's doing. And it's backed up on the field. Like, that's the thing. They had a horrific injury luck over the last 18 months. But any time they've had a semblance of their first team available, they're playing top quality rugby in sometimes in pretty grueling conditions. There's an ambition there that kind of tallies and chimes a little bit with the conversation we had with Fergal Hogan a bit earlier on. It's like, you can't just set your team up to defend. You've got to set your team up to attack. And it seems like the ambition that he has for what the game should be played like is something that I think fits really well with our culture. We like to take the fight in all our sports. All our best sports teams take the fight to the opposition. And I don't know. We kind of grope around for what the identity of Irish sport should be, but it should be front foot, I think.
And I think your point maybe almost is in line with what Andy Friend said the other day, that, you know, he hit back at Jake White because there is that real sense out there, that real disrespect towards Connacht. And if Andy Friend was doing what he was doing right now with Leinster or Munster, obviously on a greater scale, then of course he would be in the Ireland conversation, whereas you don't hear his name mentioned one bit. Now, it may be to do with the fact that there is genuinely outstanding Irish coaches and Irish candidates, and maybe that's what people see as the next move for the Irish head coach job. But I do think part of it is that he is Connacht head coach, and what he has done is produced a brilliant style of rugby over the last couple of years, which looks like it's going to get more effective over the next little while too. So he's definitely been a brilliant addition to the conversation in Irish rugby, and unbelievably dedicated to the gig in Connacht as well.
Yeah, okay. We should talk about Gordon Darcy's column today about Munster. He thinks the Munster back row is as dynamic and effective as it has been in recent seasons, that Coombs is actually a significant upgrade on standard, that Jack O'Donoghue is finally delivering on his promise, and that Peter O'Mahony makes this kind of perfect balance in that back three, and that this is the time where Munster have to deliver, that there are no excuses, there's no real weaknesses in the squad at the moment that would prevent them from going to a European final and from winning the league. Is that, am I paraphrasing correctly?
Well, part of me thinks this is yerra 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 from Gordon Darcy, you know, saying that the pressure's on Munster going into this year's campaign, but the main part of me thinks that he is spot on about this. And when you see some of the talent that came off the bench the other day in Zeebo and Snyman and the players who they were replacing having a decent evening, certainly in the second half, you're like, okay, the depth is getting better. And I know this false dawn has emerged at times over the last couple of years where you're like, okay, maybe the depth is there, because that was always the trump card for Leinster, that you could probably live with them for 50 minutes and then you couldn't live with them because the quality, the test quality coming off the bench. And maybe Munster are getting to that level. And as you say, he focuses in on the back row, and he even refers to Jack Conan, who's coming back from the Lions, looking down the M7, thinking to himself, there's a battle with Gavin Coombs here, and that battle will get more intense because Coombs is thriving in a back row that doesn't have CJ Stander. And while Stander has been an unbelievable servant for Munster and for Ireland, there is a bit more dynamism now about this back row, according to Gordon Darcy. There is a bit more invention that is required, and someone like Coombs is thriving in that scenario. It's going to be hard to decide who is your number four to number eight over the next few months when everybody's back fully fit. Like, he picks out Byrne, Snyman, Klein, O'Mahony, Coombs and Jack O'Donoghue. Five into six there. So whoever's coming off the bench there is still of an unreal standard. Now, there will be injuries. It always happens in the second and back row, but that depth is getting stronger. Like, he talks about Ben Healy and Keenan Knox and says that they're two guys that are going to have to make season-defining contributions. And I think the best thing you can say about those players at the moment is that we just don't know what they're going to be like when they're in the white heat of a top-quality battle. But the early signs, again, are really, really good. And Healy, in particular, just looks exceptional. And it's just not even to do with his skill set. It's to do with his confidence and how he does not look out of place whatsoever when he's coming into these games. As I say, there will be higher pressure scenarios for these players beyond the first couple of weeks of the URC. But the early signs, you have to accept, are very positive.
Yeah, and you must be properly be excited by what you're seeing at the moment.
100%, and it comes back to that idea that you have a squad where you're like, this is something that can challenge for trophies. The only thing is that it is a squad that has to challenge for trophies, and it really does. And I think that the squad that they've had in previous years has challenged. It's just fallen short, in particular against Leinster in defining games on a domestic level. And I think that's where things have fallen flat. I think last year Toulouse were much better in the Champions Cup. Of course, the on the day, the game could have gone differently for Munster, in fairness. It could have, but I think quality-wise, Toulouse just looked to have the edge on Munster in a couple of different departments, and particularly in the halfbacks. And it's just going to be really interesting to see how Munster develop in that area over the next little while. And it comes back to Healy again, it comes to Craig Casey. But also to see that level of performance from Conor Murray that prompted Warren Gatland in the first place to make him Lions captain, to get that level of performance from Joey Carberry, which made him one of the most exciting young talents in Irish rugby. Like, if all those things come together with this renewed grunt and depth up front, absolutely this is a team that can challenge on both fronts. You do just have to be cautious, because it feels like we've said this exact same thing over previous seasons with Munster, but this
feels
a level above, you know?
It does feel different, because you've still got Diolende to pepper in as well. Now, there was that kind of nagging issue of the November internationals and the South Africans going off and playing there and coming back, and just how tired they're going to be, because Diolende has played a lot of rugby and he's been away for a long time. So, but
the thing with Diolende is that we started to see a really positive version of him at the end of last season, and I wonder, was that because he wasn't involved in the Six Nations? You know, that, like, once you get to the business end of the season, actually the South Africans are going to be the ones that are in good nick.
Maybe it's a fair point. A couple of quick GAA comments rolling in. You can get us on 0879 180 180, or you can leave a comment in the YouTube stream. You can get us at Twitter, on Twitter, at Off the Ball AM. Hitting home for Sheehan that the Golden Kerry generation not only has an angry Dublin to deal with, but a Tyrone side with very good management, and now have the confidence boost of an All-Ireland, says Will. And Kevin says, thanks for the memories, Fergal. Number four was up there with number one. It does. It the point, I think, about the quality of footballer they have and the ability of the cornerbacks and the halfbacks to kick long range points at the outside of the boot is that there is a bedrock of good quality, self confident, collar up footballers in Tyrone club football who we don't know anything about, and that their underage structures have been belching out these good players year after year after year. But it did feel like Tyrone were hamstrung a little bit by the end of the Mickey Hart Jenner era, where defensive football was the solidity in which they were going to be built, and the attacking side of it wasn't an afterthought, but it wasn't fully evolved. Now it seems like it's fully evolved, and they still have that muscle memory of what the defensive formation is supposed to look like, and they have the confidence of the All-Ireland. And I think this is definitely a bleak midwinter for you, Owen, as a Kerry fan.
It's always a bleak midwinter. It hasn't been a positive one in 8 years. So there's no getting away from that. And also the fact that the Dubs are going to be back next year. And I think we've maybe glossed over that a little bit over the last couple of months. But that's only natural when Tyrone win an All-Ireland in the way that they did, and with the squad that they did. And I think that is the main thing we need to take away from the season that they had, is that there's not going to be any significant retirements. Their bench was sensational. Their management are going nowhere. Tyrone are never not hungry. It just paints a brilliant picture next year. Even if we've got a crap championship format, it should still be a decent football championship.
Please don't give us a crap championship format. Please. You've got a chance here. You've got a chance. Okay. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. We are going to take a quick break. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette, but your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We're back next talking boxing with Nicola Tallant.
OTB AM.
About 15, 20 years ago, there was a golden age of professional boxing in Ireland, where all the biggest boxers from the UK and obviously Irish boxers were able to fight at the point, and they would put on big shows, generally a Brian Peters promotion. Multiple world champions came here and fought defences of their crowns. We had Wayne McCullough fighting. We had Bernard Dunn selling out the point, but while it was still the point, and it was a brilliant moment for the sport in Ireland. And really, you can see that the inspiration that it had on the kids who came through were the generation who've done so well at Olympic Games for us. But that all stopped. And one of the reasons why it stopped is because of the involvement of organised crime with the sport in Ireland. To get to the bottom of that, I'm delighted to say we're talking about a new book. It's called Clash of the Clans, and it's from best-selling author and award-winning journalist Nicola Tallant. And it's available now in all bookshops. And we're delighted to welcome Nicola to the show. Nicola, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
This is really it is a crime story, but it's also a sports story, and that's why we feel very comfortable covering it. There hasn't been any significant professional shows put on in a long time in this country, and I think it is all traced back to the involvement of organised crime in the sports. When did you realise that this was the next subject for a book, that actually the story is so long form at this point that the only way to deal with it properly, to explain the characters and what's happened, is in book form?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, I had to kind of go pretty far back to explain what happened from a Brian point of view and the development of the first Irish mafia. But within that and the sort of journey of discovery I was on myself in it, I think the boxing story starts around 2013, when I was in Marbella to investigate the sort of re-emergence of the Kinahan Mafia after they had supposedly been shut down by Operation Shovel, which was a multi-agency assault on them by police forces across Europe. But while out there, we were sort of pointed in the direction of this small gym that had started up just outside Porta Banús. And it was, they had always, sort of the criminals on the Costa had always met and used gyms and gyms as such as a meeting place. They kind of, while they like to think that they are irregular in their activities, they're actually very regular. They usually get up in the morning, head to the gym, do a bit of a workout and then have a breakfast later, and always in the same places. But anyway, this new gym had opened and we were told if we were looking for any of the Irish, that's where we'd find them. And on a roundabout outside Porta Banús, I found myself looking down into what looked like a car park with a sign above it called MGM. And really that's where it started. And Daniel Kinahan and Matthew Macklin had just opened the gym in the months previous. It sort of just looked as if it could have been a hobby more than anything else. But, you know, you can see kind of over the next 2 years how it expands beyond anything I think that I'd ever seen before in the sport of boxing.
Why did it expand? How did it expand?
Well, it just expanded really quickly. And there was obviously money in it. In the beginning in Marbella, it opened as a gym that was a non-for-profit organization, and it was running events that were raising funds for charity, in particular a children's charity that was based there. It was appearing, Macklin and others involved in the gym were appearing in society pages out in Marbella, and you know, it didn't look like it was coming to anything, even though celebrities who visited the area were invited in to train. There was photographs of them put up on the social media sites. There was obviously a good marketing sort of network behind it. But around 2013 into 2014, you can see they start bringing in the big name boxers. Thomas Stalker was one of the first ones to go in from the UK. His joining of the gym made front page news in Liverpool. He joined up. Declan Geraghty was one of the first Irish boxers to join up. And you can just see them starting to very quickly sign. I think by around 2015, you know, in that short period of about 18 months, they'd signed 100 boxers.
That's the bit where the management company becomes a big story in terms of the actual sport of boxing. Up to this point, it had kind of been a gym where people trained for fights and there was some link with a management company, but you weren't quite sure where it was going to go. At this point, it becomes clear that this is a new enterprise and a new business, and the intention of the business is to own the management rights to some very significant boxers and to grow that stable to not just tens, but hundreds of boxers.
Yeah, most definitely. And they were also organising big, you know, big events here in Ireland in 2014 and 2015. And there was promises of great things. And I think for the boxers that were signing up, if you go back and you look at what they had to say at the time before it kind of became maybe caustic to talk about Daniel Kinahan, they were all very much, very openly talking about Kinahan being involved, being their manager. A lot of them were talking about not really having other opportunities, not having anywhere else to go, and finding this sort of nirvana out in Spain, that they were being paid to do what they loved to do. They were being offered accommodation. Their families were moving out. There was a lot of hope. And, you know, they were being sold this dream, which I think they probably still are, that that they would be well paid, and that, you know, they'd have fights put on, and that boxing was alive and well again when MGM, later MTK, was on the scene. You know, if you look at Paddy Barnes, the former Irish Olympic boxer, when he signed up, he actually said that there was nothing else on the table for him, and he was about to lose his grant from Sports Ireland because it had, you know, his time was up with that. He was on a grant of about 40,000 a year, and he had a new child there, and, you know, he needed to earn money. So when MGM came knocking, it was a dream come true for him. It was a job, it was a wage. So that's what they were offering the boxers. And a lot of them, if you look at when they went out to Spain to train out there, they were staying in very luxury accommodation. They were being treated like proper sports stars. So very attractive.
There was certainly an ignorance, I think, in the public, or maybe just a lack of awareness in the public about what was going on at the start, like that 2013 to 2015 period. Was there an acceptable ignorance maybe within the boxing community as well, and those fighters, that there was an innocence almost to what the fighters were getting involved in?
I think people tried to, you know, I think people were happy to turn a blind eye more than anything else. I was writing in the book as I was going through that time period, you know, Macklin was going to the US to fight at one point, and Daniel Kinahan and the late Gary Hutch posted photographs with him, and they were having a little send-off for him in Spain because they couldn't travel. They wouldn't be able to go with him to spectate because they wouldn't have got into the US. And what you had was this bizarre situation that on the back pages of a newspaper, you'd have a story that, you know, Macklin was going to, you know, chase his dreams, basically, to reignite his career. And on the front pages, you had the story that, you know, Macklin and the mob, that, the you know, they were travelling en masse. A lot of the senior members of the Irish Mafia were going out with him to support him. So it was this very strange situation that really has gone on until recently, that you have sports journalists sort of, you know, just ignoring the fact that the organised crime is very heavily involved in boxing. And obviously, Kinahan was one of the founders of MGM. We've been told he's nothing to do with it now. It had changed name and it had been sold, and we've been told repeatedly that he's nothing to do with it. And yet then he comes forward and he says, actually, he does. He's an advisor to these very, very well-known boxers.
It's always that that line where you cover events and then covering the entourage is tricky. And I suspect that's why many of the papers were doing one story on the front and one story on the back.
Yeah, or just it was a different thing. I just think that in the sport of boxing, it seems to be sort of acceptable. I've spoken to you before about Senate hearings in the US in the 80s, where you had one of John Gotti's men talking about how the mob used boxing to wash their dirty funds. And that was a very clear insight into why organised crime groups saw the sport of boxing as useful to them for many reasons. And, you know, you have a long history there in the sport with involvement of criminals, well-known criminals. And, you know, it's a sport maybe of the working classes as well. And that's maybe where it spurs from in the first place. But I just think, like, I found it myself absolutely amazing to see this sport just allow the likes of the name of Kinahan just seep into it as if it was totally normal that somebody like that would be involved. I'm not sure another sport that I can think of would have that.
So certainly amateur boxing has had its struggles. There's one of the FIFA, the FBI's most wanted list, heavily involved with the International Amateur Boxing Association, as it was. it's because boxing is so fragmented, it's difficult for the whole sport to have it's difficult to take it all as one. So if a promoter and a fighter are involved with somebody from organized crime to make the fights that everybody wants to see, you sometimes have to get in bed with unsavory characters. And we've seen this again throughout history in the past, where the public demands the fight and there's so much money to be made that everybody holds their nose and pays the money and watches the fight. So it's kind of like everybody is complicit.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the biggest problem there is for the big corporates. And you know, we saw that in the recent past there when Tyson Fury came out and name-checked Kinahan, and, you know, that went on to create world headlines and Panorama documentary earlier this year, which detailed his involvement in the sport. It's the corporate structures like Sky and other companies like that that have the bigger problem than the ordinary punter who's going to put their hand in their pocket and pay to view. You're not really, you don't have anyone much to answer to. You know, you want to see the fight, that's the beginning and the end of it. But the big business that are in bed with them and taking the money and you know, paying out money to groupings that are linked to organised crime, they really are the ones that have the issue, I think.
Do you find then that when it comes to the coverage, that there is a difference as a result of the events of earlier this year, Nicola, between maybe the Irish media coverage and the international media coverage, where the international coverage is now at a place where maybe the Irish coverage was in 2015, or that fight in the US that you allude to there, whatever it was, 7 years ago, 6 years ago at this point?
Yeah. I mean, I think that Panorama documentary did a lot to raise awareness of it. And you know, it's hard to tell. There's an awful lot of online activity and awareness of it. But, you know, I'd still be reading about you know, bouts that are still desired to be put on and no mention of the background and the people involved. So it is quite extraordinary. Now, from a crime point of view, the investigations are continuing into the Kinahan organisation, and you know, there might be developments in that over the coming 12 months. We've seen a lot of developments recently in relation to some of the investigations that are ongoing here. So it is kind of the overall plan to dismantle completely that mob is in its final stages now. And I think there's an end in sight. So it'd be interesting to see how that will be handled. And, you know, from a boxing point of view, will that be ignored as well? You know, and does the show go on no matter what?
Yeah, I'd say yes is the answer to that. I'd say history will teach us that, yeah. And actually, if there was a dismantling of that operation, boxing would go, well, all's well that ends well. You know, it's almost a get out of jail in some respects, if you excuse my mixed metaphors. Can you take us back to the there's a hinge point, I think, in certainly in the public's awareness of the involvement of organized crime and boxing, and that's the Regency Hotel, where the public is awakened to the fact that, like, because there had been a number of events, as you said before, that where there'd be a weigh-in, we'd cover them, we'd go, the fights would be on, sometimes they'd be big enough to draw media attention, sometimes they wouldn't, but it was certainly felt like there was the genesis of a new boxing industry was here. And then, like, I remember in the build-up to that going, is this something that we need to staff? Are the fights big enough? Probably not. No need to send anybody to this. And in retrospect, pretty glad we didn't send anybody on the day, because it was obviously a horrific scene. Like, it has become kind of a little bit, in how we speak about it, a bit cartoonish because of the video that comes out afterwards. But actually, you know, there's murder in a hotel in a city where this is not what we've come to expect from day-to-day life. It's a really horrific moment in Irish society that we've sometimes, I think, it feels like we forget about that.
It's funny you should say that about not sending people to cover, because actually we were, as a news reporting team covering crime, we were attending a lot of these weigh-ins in advance of the Regency. We were there not probably you know, visibly. We were there in the background and outside in surveillance vans for the gathering of that intelligence as regards what's going on within the mob, because you can get, in the same way as investigators will get intelligence from watching who's with who arrives with who, sometimes even the positioning of people in a car when you see who's the driver, who's in the front seat, who's in the back seat. All these things go to make up, it's like a tapestry of what's happening. And obviously in the run up to that Regency, we had been doing a lot of work on this fallout that had started within the Kinahan organised crime group. Really, I think the shooting of Jamie Moore in Daniel Kinahan's garden in Spain in 2014 was the proper start of it, as such, as we realised there was something going on. Jamie Moore was a coach and he was out working with Macklin at the time, and he had been out for a night, came back to this beautiful gated villa late and let himself in the gate and was walking up towards the house when he would later describe himself in an interview. He was approached by a shadowy figure. He initially thought it was a joke when he saw him, because the Irish crew out there and within the gym were very friendly, and they had, you know, they obviously used to play tricks on one another. So he initially thought it was a joke, but then he saw the flash of gunfire and felt the pain, and he was shot and left pretty much to die in the garden. He had very little juice left on his phone. Daniel Kinahan and Gary Hutch, who would later be murdered, were inside the house, but it was so vast that they couldn't hear him. So he eventually managed to get on a 911 call and used his phone to tell the emergency services where he was. Now, that attack at the time was blamed by the Kinahan Mafia publicly as being, you know, a fallout with the Russians or something like that. But actually what was going on was a fallout within the group. And that's what resulted in the Regency Hotel attack. Gary Hutch was blamed on that shooting. He disappeared to Amsterdam, where he was kidnapped. He escaped like a scene out of The Bourne Identity. He returned to Ireland. His uncle stepped in, the godfather of the family, and a deal was supposedly done. But the deal was reneged on when Hutch was murdered in Spain in September 2015. And the kickback from that was the Regency Hotel.
And that's the potted history, essentially, of the Hutch versus Kinahan feud that claimed so many lives in Dublin inner city over the period of about five or 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Look, this attack on the Regency Hotel was a murder attempt on Daniel Kinahan. David Byrne was tragically murdered, and he was unfortunate. He was there, but he wasn't the target. Daniel Kinahan was the target, and he knew he was the target. He escaped, and, you know, the retribution for that, for attacking somebody who was essentially the head of that mob, came fast and furious. And 18 to 20 people's murders have been linked to the feud. Most of them are on the side of the Hutch faction, the murder victims. There was only maybe one, I think, which would have been seen as being a Kinahan associate, was killed. And all that's happened since, we have 60 members of the, certainly associates of the mob behind bars. A lot of it has been taken down. The powerhouse here in Ireland is gone, and in the UK, that has all been dismantled. And, you know, the final phase is ongoing. But it's all so deeply embedded in boxing, every bit of it, you know. And even from before all these big events happened, boxing has been at the heart and soul of the Irish Mafia. And Kinahan, I've described him before as a bit of a Pablo Escobar character, in that Escobar loved football and bought the football team. Kinahan absolutely adores boxing, and that's his passion in life. And it has been, always has been his passion. He has very high ambitions for himself within that sport.
Nicola, from your own perspective, there are a number of moments peppered throughout the book that an ordinary journalist would look at and say, Christ, those are incredible slash awful situations to be in. You mentioned there that the surveillance around the Regency that day. When you're writing this book, when you're compiling all those moments and getting them together, are you looking back and thinking, God, I have seen quite some things. I've been in some situations myself, even just as a reporter on this beat.
Yeah, I suppose so, actually. And to the way I wrote it was to kind of put a bit of myself into it as well, maybe to give people a little bit of intimacy with the story and a bit of insight into the work of a crime journalist, because it seems to be, everyone seems to be interested in it, you know, where for me it's an ordinary job. But when I started to put together the stuff that had gone on and the journey of discovery that I have been on myself, really, to understand this, what this is and where it came from as well, because that's important, because, you know, criminals don't just come out of thin air. They come from marginalized places that society creates. So, you know, it's all our fault, this. It's not just them and us. But yeah, there was a couple of hairy moments when I look back, or when I put them together, they look worse really than when they're separated. You know, there's some bit of black humor as well involved in covering this stuff. And certainly I've met some interesting characters along the way as well. But yeah, I think it just gives a little bit more, a little bit of an intimacy with the story for readers.
From your own perspective, was there a moment that was the most hairy, that was the one that maybe had you thinking twice about what you were doing, or does that never come into your head?
Well, God, it does. Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, probably some of the hairy moments aren't in the book, but some of them are. But certainly when we were spotted, or I was spotted in Portobello's by one of the Kinahan heavies while as we were actually on an investigation and had photographed Christy Kinahan Senior in the port. It was a stupid idea to go for a drink, but we were kind of feeling that we were the cats that got the cream when we photographed him that night. But you know, that was a moment where it was alert and calm that got us out of that situation. I was recognised in the bar. One of my team spotted the guy recognising me, basically watching me, and followed him into a bathroom where he heard him on the phone calling for backup. And, you know, there was something going to happen that night, but we were able to move and separate and get out of there. But I suppose all these things are how you learn to behave in the job. You learn to be quite alert, always watching your back, especially when working, you know. So and, you know, continue to learn as we continue to work in you know, you're working, I suppose, in a dangerous enough environment at times.
And the story keeps getting bigger and bigger, like with the elevation of the fighters that Daniel Kinahan is connected to reaching the world heavyweight title. Essentially, we've seen, as you said, Tyson Fury making global news by mentioning the fact that Daniel Kinahan was giving him advice. In your view, how involved is Kinahan at the moment with the biggest fights that we're seeing in the world? Because the MTK fighters are still fighting for world titles. The Canelo versus Billy Joe Saunders, Fury versus Wilder, the trilogy is, you know, without the added story, one of the most interesting fights that we've had in a long period of time. This rivalry is a proper bona fide rivalry in the heavyweight division, which is like, the whole world stops to watch this. Mm-hmm. How involved do you think at the moment Daniel Kinahan is with Fury and those fighters and with MTK?
You know, I think he's as involved as we were told he was, which is right in there. He's the power broker. And we have been told that by him and by, you know, others within the MTK company, although they insist that he's not been paid, or there's no money basically caught up in it, and he doesn't actually have a job, he doesn't have a role. they seem to be managing to get around it all by calling him an advisor. But, you know, Daniel Kinahan is hugely invested in boxing, absolutely hugely invested in boxing. And I suppose you can't say that without pointing out that he has been, or is believed to have been, at the very top of a European super cocaine cartel made up of the Irish, the Italian Camorra Mafia, the Bosnian Tito and Dino grouping, and the Macra Mafia, which are the Dutch Moroccans, many of whom are on trial, and one of whom is actually threatening the Prime Minister of the Netherlands at the moment. He's got security. So he's made millions, possibly billions, from flooding Europe with cocaine. So, you know, he's heavily invested in his hobby, his sport, his passion of boxing. And, you know, there's no question, there's no denying it. He's told us that himself. So I have no reason to believe that he's in any way separated from that. Now, look, you know, we'll see what happens with Daniel Kinahan over the coming months. But contacts of mine who would be very close to him and within his circle and moving within those boxing circles would tell me that a lot of people feel they can't disentangle themselves from Kinahan, and that a lot of people, both inside and outside boxing, would feel almost relief if he was arrested, because it would be an end of sorts to it. I think a lot of people are frightened of him, terrified of what he is and what he can do, and they have just got themselves too heavily involved with him, and there's no way out.
I think that's an important point when people criticise the boxers, particularly the young boxers, who actually, as you talked about earlier on, having no real choice. There's no option or opportunity for them, and somebody comes and offers them an opportunity. And it's not just an opportunity the way a normal job opportunity comes. If you say no, you're saying no to some pretty difficult people to say no to. I think that's kind of an underrated part of the story.
Oh, most definitely. And there's all sorts of stories about people being threatened and being advised that, you know, you really should say yes. And I have absolutely no doubt to, you know, I believe that 100%, because I know exactly how they operate. And somebody like Daniel Kinahan will always get what he wants. And very few people will stand up to him. And that's just the way things are, and the power that people within the criminal underworld hold over others. So I think that there's a lot of people out there. Look, in the end of the day, the boxers want to feed their families. They want a wage. It's what they do for a living. If I was in their shoes, I'd probably be saying yes to the job as well. And I don't think there's any blame to be put on them. I think that, you know, money corrupts, and it also feeds greed, and we all of us have it in us to be greedy and to want more and more. And I think, and I've seen it so much within criminal circles, that you know, you see people and they're still involved and they have more money than they'll ever be able to spend in their life, and yet they just keep doing more and more, you know, crimes basically, and gathering more. Same could be said in the corporate world, though. And with all of this, the same could be said in the corporate world. There are people like Daniel Kinahan, and there's others who are in the boardroom in the same way that they're, you know, in the realms of gangland. It is a personality. It's a kind of a narcissistic personality that succeeds, because, like, realistically, if you don't have any empathy, you'd probably do better than if you do. But yeah, I think the boxers aren't to blame. They're just taking a wage. But there's people higher up that would be very happy to see this conclude, and to basically, I suppose, have the guards make this business decision for them, to separate them from Kinahan.
Yeah, no doubt. Nicola Tallant, great stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. The new book is out. It's called Clash of the Clans. You can get it in all good bookshops now. I should, of course, remind you that Daniel Kinahan has no criminal convictions. He was named in the High Court in 2018 as a senior figure in organised crime on an international scale. 9.36 this morning here on OTBAM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We've got a very busy show, or a busy day for you on OTB Sports Radio. You should tune into that on OTB Sports app. Harry Edwards talking about OJ, Mount Rushmore's Cork, the importance of Club GAA is our retro panel, and Catherine Switzer talking about the Boston Marathon at 6 o'clock. It's Boston Marathon week this week. So definitely worth tuning in for that little bit of history. We're talking about Ireland and Stephen Kenny on tomorrow's show. We're going to be joined by James Scale and Dervla O'Rourke. We have a pro-Kenny versus anti-Kenny faction debate on the show tomorrow.
OTB AM
with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.